sure, Bitcoin is a new technology and it's magic money for the internet and some points or tokens that you can buy and stick in an app, but what the hell does any of that mean? I get that Bitcoin is a thing, but what is it? Well, let's get into it. This is the first episode of the Bitcoin Basics series. Bitcoin, what is it? The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we are starting into our Bitcoin Basics series. And I've decided to just refer to it as Basics. So you'll see, you know, Basics and then the number. And I'm going to try to get these in some sensible order. There's a lot to cover with this. And you know, like we can hit cryptography elements, we can hit historical elements, we can hit, you know, just the basic technical details of how Bitcoin works. And basically what I want to start with is, what is Bitcoin? And I know we've covered this in a lot of different ways, and I'll use some analogies, but I just want to hit like a bunch of terms that you're going to be hearing. And this will be as noob-friendly as I can make it. I know I have a tendency to use jargon or language because I've been in Bitcoin for a really, 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 really long time. So any feedback is greatly, greatly appreciated. And I'll take some time to clarify anything if you guys have any questions in whatever episode follows our basics episode. So what I want to do is we're just going to dive in and figure this thing out as we go. And I'll make corrections and simplifications to how we're doing this, and maybe even clean up old episodes so that this can be like a very, very specific series that we can put together as an introduction to all of the main important things to understand about how Bitcoin works, what Bitcoin is, and what it does. Real quick, let's thank our sponsors who brought you this episode, and then we will dive in. If you are looking for a way to get into Bitcoin for the simplest, no-nonsense way that is going to give you the best resource and is not going to confuse you or lead you astray or get you wrapped up in any scams, you're looking for Swan Bitcoin. Go to swanbitcoin.com/guy. Don't go anywhere else. I promise you, Swan Bitcoin is the place to start. The link will be in the show notes. And if you want to keep your Bitcoin safe, we'll learn about this in today's episode, but what you want is a hardware wallet. The Cold Card Mark IV is both a very versatile and a very, very secure hardware wallet. And this is for your cold storage. This is for the Bitcoin that is offline, not connected to anything, and is safe from hackers or a broken phone, etc. And you can get 9% off your cold card and everything else in your cart with the code BitcoinAudible. That's this show. And then lastly, there is no better way to stack Bitcoin every single day for the absolute lowest cost possible is the Fold debit card. This is a way to get sats back on everything that you do. The Fold debit card is my main card. I use it for everything. And just as an example, I got about 26,000 sats back today. And I didn't even spend that much today. First, I had an Amazon purchase and I got an Amazon gift card because you get a lot more percent back by using their gift cards. We got coffee this morning and breakfast. My county gas bill came in. We got some smoothies. And that's it. I got about 26,000 sats on those. And that's $5. You know how much it costs for the premium card? $10 a month. Today. Just with a couple of things I did today, I've paid for half of my monthly fee. This was not a big day of spending. And I have 17 almost 17 and a half million sats, which is right now $3,967 just because I use this card. And if you download the app and just make an account, you don't have to get the card or do anything. Just check out the app. 20,000 sats straight out the gate. This is an awesome way for someone who is brand new to it to start stacking. Links to all of this stuff and details in the show notes. All right. So what is Bitcoin? Now, I've got a guy's take just not hitting the technicals, but hitting the idea of Bitcoin. And it's called What the Hell Even Is Bitcoin? And it's more talking about the concept of money, what money is, why it's possible to have, not only is it possible, but every money has tended toward a virtual version. Like even when we were using gold as money, we still just used notes that were exchangeable for gold. And if you start digging into the properties of money, there's some very, very interesting truths that you can discern from that reality. The fact that we were using paper notes that didn't actually mean anything, and they weren't actually worth anything, but they were held into secure record by the fact that there was a physical thing that couldn't be counterfeited to back it. But we didn't need the physical thing. In fact, the physical thing was a pain in the butt. So much so that we went out of our way to make this redeemable note to use instead of the physical thing. There's some very interesting things that you can learn about money when you think about it from that context and realize that the physical part of it was actually a drawback. It was a bad thing, except that it made the notes mean something because they were exchangeable one for one of something that was counterfeit proof. But for it to work, we didn't need the thing itself. We just needed the counterfeit proofness. So that's something to hang on to. But I want to talk less about money in this episode and more about purely what Bitcoin is. Like from a technical standpoint, what is a network? What is peer-to-peer digital cash, etc., etc.? I will, however, link to that episode, to that guy's take, because I think that is also an equally fun discussion, I highly recommend it. It's a really good one to start on, and I've gotten a lot of great feedback. In fact, user Servagro boosted 500 sats on Fountain, and it was that episode. It's Guys Take 44, Bitcoin is Not What You Think It Is. That's right. I forgot that that was the title. I made a playlist that was called What the Hell Even Is Bitcoin. But it's called Bitcoin Is Not What You Think It Is. And his comment, dude, thank you, by the way. Thank you so much for the 500 sats. It says, amazing listen. The information about the foundations of money is the best I have heard. I will listen again. So many points were made that I want committed to memory. That is awesome. Thank you, man. And I'm glad you enjoyed it. That was a really fun episode. It continues to stick out in my own mind as something that, a rant that was really fun because I love the idea of money, and it's amazing what the world looks like and what the processes and our systems look like what I believe to be a genuine understanding of money, because it's a totally different worldview. You look at things that you thought worked one way and you're like, holy crap, they literally work completely the opposite. And our ignorance around money is very deep. So again, I highly recommend Guys Take 44. I think people have told me that it was very useful. So to kick off Bitcoin basics number one, and to hit on the idea of what Bitcoin is, we're going to start very simply, and we're going to let Satoshi introduce this by just reading the abstract to the Bitcoin white paper. So for the sake of people who are brand new, the white paper was just the announcement paper. It was released on October 31st, 2008, and it was Satoshi revealing to the world, posted on the cryptography mailing list, that I'm working on a project and it's called Bitcoin and it's peer-to-peer digital cash. There was not a lot of fanfare. Nobody knew it was anything interesting. There had been numerous attempts at digital cash and digital cash systems previously. And honestly, a lot of people in the cypherpunk community and cryptography mailing list at the time had kind of become disenfranchised with it and thinking that none of these things were going to work. Though there was a contingent that was still like gung-ho about it. Hal Finney, which you'll hear about, who was the first person to run Bitcoin other than Satoshi, was ever the optimist and actually was interested in it from the outset. But Satoshi posted this, and sure enough, Bitcoin was introduced to the world. So the white paper is titled Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. Abstract. A purely peer-to-peer version of electronic cash would allow online payments to be sent directly from one party to another without going through a financial institution. Digital signatures provide part of the solution, but the main benefits are lost if a trusted third party is still required to prevent double spending. We propose a solution to the double spending problem using a peer-to-peer network. The network timestamps transactions by hashing them into an ongoing chain of hash-based proof of work, forming a record that cannot be changed without redoing the proof of work. The longest chain not only serves as proof of the sequence of events witnessed, but proof that it came from the largest pool of CPU power. As long as a majority of CPU power is controlled by nodes that are not cooperating to attack the network, they'll generate the longest chain and outpace attackers. The network itself requires minimal structure. Messages are broadcast on a best effort basis, and nodes can leave and rejoin the network at will, accepting the longest proof of work chain as proof of what happened while they were gone. So, I'm sure to a lot of people that probably sounds really jargony. There are a lot of cryptography and, you know, age-old digital cash terms involved in this, or in just this short paragraph. And if you hadn't been on the cryptography mailing list at the time and, you know, having conversations with these people, a lot of this might be very confusing. So what we're going to do is we're going to explain what the hell all of that was. So going back to the example I made of gold, is that the reason we've been using quote-unquote virtual currencies practically since the kind of 1500s, 1600s era. As soon as we became a global economy, where we were genuinely doing trade, a great, great book that essentially details out the history of money, of our monetary systems, called Layered Money by Nick Bhatia, one that I also did the audiobook for. Seriously, a genuinely fantastic book, and it goes through the Amsterdam Bourse, which was essentially the first quote-unquote stock exchange in a sense, but it was like a seasonal, once a year exchange where people traveled, merchants and, you know, major producers and stuff traveled from all over the world to make large exchanges, to make contracts and promises in this single place. And essentially they used money substitutes, and they created this form of stock, this redemption note, that became a currency that was redeemable for money or goods, but were not the actual money and goods themselves. Like, it was a virtual note. And like I said about notes redeemable from with gold, is the thing that you needed the notes to have, the characteristics that you needed the notes to have, that the physical gold provided, was the fact that it couldn't be counterfeited. It was insanely hard to acquire more of, so the notes ended up being traded rather than just issuing more notes or creating more notes. And in the same sense, you there's a whole lot less activity spent trying to go find more gold than there is actually producing things in the economy. And that's part of what makes money work, is that it's so scarce that it makes more sense to just build stuff than it is to try to get more money bring more money into the network, into the economy. But the critical characteristics that the notes typically did not have, that having a trusted party connect them or tether them to a physical thing like gold, were counterfeit proof or counterfeit resistance, so to speak, because obviously you could still counterfeit notes, and so could the trusted third party. That's where we are today. But it was counterfeit resistance and scarcity. And then for hundreds of years, we tried to come up with different schemes and different government systems and different banking systems, all in an attempt to make a better virtual money. And we went through all sorts of different options. And then, you know, we tried to make the bills more secure. And then the finances of the third party ended up like this. This is when you would have bank runs and you would find out that a bank issued, you know, 100 million notes for 100 million gold coins. And turns out they only had like 50 million gold coins. And you'd have bank runs because people found out that the notes weren't worth what they were supposed to be worth. They no longer had the counterfeit resistance that gold provided. And so they rushed to get the real money that did have the counterfeit proof or counterfeit resistance and did have the scarcity, and the banks would go under. And the same thing happens with governments. In fact, most people don't realize that the last 150 years, we think of it as like, oh, governments just run money. This is normal. And this is how the world works. This is how money works. No, this is actually an anomaly in throughout all of human history, really, is for governments to completely control and blindly or out of thin air issue money. And when you think of it in terms of historical volatility, it's the most chaotic time for money. There have been 57, according to a paper from, was it the Cato Institute? I already forgot. I mentioned it like 10 episodes back or so. But there's a paper about hyperinflationary events. And out of 57 in all of recorded history, 56 have happened in like the last 120 years. Fiat money, or money that is backed by nothing, that has no real counterfeit resistance because it's not redeemable for something that's hard to make, and it's purely managed by governments and central banks, has a horrific track record. It has the worst track record of all of our monies throughout history. The one benefit it has is its supreme virtualness in the fact that you can send it across the internet, and we have a global ecosystem which lets people in the US trade with people in China. And the efficiency boost, the productivity boost that comes with being able to do that in, you know, a matter of moments, essentially, even though the SWIFT system is really slow, you can pretend to settle it in, you know, a minute, but then it takes like a week or 2 weeks to actually clear. But regardless, the fact that you can do business online creates so much productive excess that it's actually worth the psychotic volatility and periodic collapse of a fiat currency, of a totally politically issued money. But make no mistake, it's a horrible monetary good. Historically, it's one of the worst. So do not fall to the bias that because that's the way it works today, that means it's the only way it can work. It's actually the worst way it has ever worked. The one thing is that we need it for the internet. We need a virtual money. But in that context, there is the beauty of Bitcoin. And there's another wonderful read. This is one of my most recent favorites. And it's by Derjiji, who wrote 21 Lessons, which is a wonderful introduction to Bitcoin and a lot of the different concepts in really bite-sized and just kind of blow your mind sort of pieces, so to speak. Like, each chapter is very small and it's just something incredibly interesting, and it stops as soon as it gets the point across and it doesn't go too far or too deep or too technical. 21 Lessons is a brilliant introduction into Bitcoin and a lot of the concepts behind it. if you leave that book without having been fascinated at least five times, then you weren't paying attention to it. I also happen to do the audiobook for that one because I'm the guy who's read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. But Gigi wrote another piece very recently called Digital Money, and he made a distinction that I really love. All of our monies today are virtual. None of them are real. They're all pretending to be money. They're all pretending to have the characteristics of money. They're pretending to have the scarcity of real money, gold being the prime example of the most historically accepted and longest lasting monetary good of recorded human history. But in our age, we have virtual monies. They are managed by some central party that attempts to mimic those characteristics of money. They're not real. The central bank can issue $500 trillion tomorrow morning, but it doesn't want to because that would destroy the value of their money. So they want to issue very slowly so that they get the most purchasing power benefit for themselves by being the single party that can counterfeit the money while not destroying its value so that its network stays big and we keep using it. But understand, none of its characteristics are real. They are being faked by the central party that has total and explicit control over the entire thing. And one of the great things about digital money, the read that I'm referring to here from Dergigi, that one of the distinctions that he makes that I thought was great is when he compares it to like World of Warcraft gold and what's the Second Life bucks? I forget. Life, what are they called? Whatever. The fake money in Second Life is that the Second Life gaming company manages that currency, that manages that virtual money. And then Blizzard manages the World of Warcraft gold and fake money. And they actually have economies, like Diablo 3, you know, had a vibrant economy, and they try to manage it. They literally become micro world economists, and it's so funny to actually watch a lot of the economic theories play out in those sorts of scenarios, those controlled experiments where you see what happens. You see what happens, and you see the failure of them being able to control or manage the money. But Gigi has a great detailing out of like some of these comparisons. And one of the distinctions that he makes that I thought was really, really great was that the difference between a central bank currency, virtual currency, and World of Warcraft gold is not in kind, it's in scale. They are run the exact same way, they are managed the exact same way, they have the exact same faults. One of them simply has lots of political power, massive influence, and a vastly larger network. The other is in a video game. But both have fallen to the same failures, the same mistakes, and the same mismanagements because they are centrally controlled, centrally issued, and completely costless to make more of. All of the attempts at counterfeit resistance or scarcity are purely at the whim of the central party that controls it. On the other hand, Bitcoin is the first digital money. It is a digital system that can by itself prove that it cannot be counterfeited and it cannot be cheated and that it is perfectly scarce. So in a world of nothing but virtual currencies and virtual monies, Bitcoin is the first digital money. It is not mimicking the characteristics of money. It actually has them in a digital version of the same sort of good. He makes the comparison that, you know, and the difference between an analog radio, a virtual radio, and a digital radio is that an analog radio simply uses, analog signal. And is a physical radio that you would put in your car, and it's real. A virtual radio would be something like a fake radio in Grand Theft Auto. When you get in the car and you drive around, it pretends that there's a radio and you can like change the station, but it's just pretending to look and sound like a radio. It's just a thing created in a video game. Whereas a digital radio is still actually a radio. It's just not using analog signal. It's using digital signal. And in that same sense, to use those same analogies, gold is the analog money, the dollar is the virtual money, and Bitcoin is the digital money. So that's a really long way of saying that Bitcoin is digital money. It is electronic digital cash. So how does it do that? And what does that mean exactly when we ask what Bitcoin the system is? So let's take a break right here and hit our sponsor, and then we will dive into that. Every morning, I wake up and I spin the fold wheel. I get a daily wheel and I get free sats. And that's whether or not I have the premium card, whether or not I've bought anything on the app. I don't have to do anything. I just have the app and I get a daily spin and free sats for going through my link and just checking out the app and signing up for making an account. You get 20,000 free sats. Go to guyswan.com/fold and you will see it right there. You can do that right now. Then even without the debit card, you can get gift cards at a discount that get you sats back, and you can even pay for them with Lightning, but you can pay for them with your normal debit card at your boring old normal fiat bank, which I actually did that a lot before the Fold debit card came out. But then if you get the Fold free debit card, you get sats back on all of your purchases, and you get even bigger rewards if you get the Fold premium debit card, which is what I have, and it is only $10 a month. You get even more sats back on the gift cards. You get, I think it's up to $500 worth of Amazon gift cards at 5% back every single month. You can take a base 1% back on everything that you buy. And remember, this is a debit card, not a credit card. So you're not paying them interest on anything. They're just giving you 1% back on the stuff that you purchase with the money that you have. Or you can do what I do and take a spin, which gives you all sorts of rewards. You get extra spins. You can get up to 100% back. In fact, sometimes they still have the full Bitcoin that you can actually win on the spin. You can get 2% back. You can get 100,000 sats. And I'll tell you, I actually got 100% back before on my plane to Mexico to the Bitcoin Standard Conference. That is a pretty magical feeling. Check it out at guyswan.com/fold and pick up 20,000 free sats. All right, so we have a digital money. We have digital cash. Now, Satoshi says digital signatures provide part of the solution for a peer-to-peer cash, but the main benefits are lost if a trusted third party is still required to prevent double spending. So this is what the virtual money manager has always done to mimic the properties of something that is real and physical and scarce. They were arbiters to prevent double spending, which double spending is just a fancy, or is just a specific type of counterfeiting. If I send you $100, well, then we have to make sure, particularly on the internet, you know, when we're talking about something digital, I can copy and paste it as many times as I want. So if I have a digital thing that says I got 100 tokens on a Google spreadsheet, I can copy that spreadsheet a million times, and I can send 100 tokens, whatever the hell they are, to as many people as I want. So when I send you 100 of those tokens, you have to know, and the entire system has to be able to protect against me sending those same 100 tokens to somebody else. It has to be proven and irreversibly established that I had 100 tokens and now I do not have 100 tokens, and that you did not have them, but now you do have 100 tokens, and that they came from me. This is why we always needed a central party. And this is why you didn't need it with gold, because you can't fake gold. And in the scheme of things, gold is pretty easy to verify when it comes to, you know, all of the monetary metals. So gold has this property naturally when we're talking about physical gold. But as soon as we have a virtual currency, as soon as we have something that's a digital spreadsheet or a record, well, then you have to know that people aren't cheating the record, that the record is actually legitimate, because money stops doing what money is supposed to do the second someone can double spend. Just like points in a football game are supposed to record how many touchdowns, within the rules of the game, one team has acquired, has accomplished against their opponent. Money is supposed to be a record of those things, that value that we have produced into the economy, so that we have a provable record of what we're allowed to take back out, so that we're not just suffocating the economy, like just sucking resources out of the economy and not putting anything in, because the economy needs to be sustainable. If we just consume everything and produce nothing, we all die. And that's not good. You know, at least if touchdown points in a football game, it just makes football suck and people don't watch it and people stop playing the game. But if you do that with the economy, the whole world dies. You can't do that. It is infinitely more important that the money we use to allocate and communicate value and production in the economy is fair, is actually attributed to the people who have scored touchdowns, like in our football analogy, than the point system in any other game. And think about how pissed off, how ridiculous it is to think that the referee could just be able to arbitrarily issue points to a team that hasn't scored a touchdown, and how mad the fans would be, the participants would be. And it's just a game. There's no real outcome. It's an artificial environment and an artificial set of rules that we've done to just experiment and set humans and a team of people up against a challenge so that they can come up with a creative and fascinating way to get around it and accomplish an explicit goal. And that's fun to do as humans. It's exciting. But money is the game of life. It's the game of whether we eat or starve. It's the game of whether we have a prosperous life and a chance at achieving our dreams, or we live in poverty while someone suffocates us as a parasite, eats our resources, and lives a lavish, prosperous life on our backs. That's what happens with an unfair money. At least unfair points in a football game just ruin the football game and we can just go play chess or some other thing. Unfair points, unfair money in the game of life means millions of people die, while a small select group of monetary and political masters live like kings on our backs by stealing our resources that we build and the value that we produce. They produce nothing, and they live off of us. The double spending problem is not an arbitrary small problem. The double spending problem, solving that problem, is the problem of making. If you cannot solve the double spending problem, you do not have good money. If you do not have good money, you cannot have efficient, sustainable exchange and trade. If you cannot have efficient, sustainable trade, you cannot have the division of labor. If you do not have the division of labor, you do not have society. We are back to tribes that must and can only deal with people we know and trust in our inner circle. And that is it. That is the end of the scaling of society. And the best we can do is like a tribe of 100 people. We are back to hunter-gatherers. And that means about 7.5 billion people die, and maybe a few million people scattered around the world can actually sustain themselves. Understand. The problem and the value of a sound money is the biggest problem and the most important value of an economic system. All other quote-unquote utility or services or you know, specialities, whatever it is all subservient to the fact that we can cooperate as a society without having to know or trust each other because we have a language to communicate and exchange value. That is what money accomplishes. And solving the double spending problem is what establishes a good money that works. All of our virtual monies to date, for hundreds of years now, have only been able to mimic the solving of this problem. And they have done so by creating monetary masters, by creating a special group of people who are the judges, or really they posture themselves as if they are judges, but really they are masters, because they have the authority to arbitrarily change and double spend the money in the system. And they use and abuse the living crap out of that power. Now, when we are making digital cash, we want the ledger, we want the monetary units to only be accessible by the digital signature. Now, we'll talk about signatures and private public keys and all the cryptography stuff in another episode of Basics. But right now, we're just talking about, we're saying that we need a digital proof that the owner is the only one that can unlock these units. So in the context of like 100 tokens before, when they belonged to me, I need to be able to make sure that the way the system is designed, I am the only one who can move them. Not only can I not move them to two different people at the same time, I have to be able to send you 100 tokens and not be able to send it to anyone else, but it needs to be sure that I am the only one who can unlock those 100 tokens. Now, that is digital signatures. And this was a critical piece of all of the previous attempts at digital cash. And Satoshi says that, you know, digital signatures provide part of the solution, but the main benefits are lost if a trusted third party is still required to prevent double spending. And that is the ultimate problem, is that essentially you don't really own anything. Even if your digital signature is required and you actually are the only one who can produce your digital signature, and that's required to unlock those 100 tokens, it doesn't matter if somebody can wish 100 trillion tokens out of thin air and spend them at will, because your 100 tokens are now worthless. So what does Bitcoin do? We propose a solution to the double spending problem using a peer-to-peer network that timestamps transactions by hashing them into an ongoing chain of hash-based proof of work, forming a record that cannot be changed without redoing the proof of work. Whew, that's a lot. So the word Bitcoin is a handful of different things. It is Bitcoin the unit, so it's the token on the network. Bitcoin is the network itself that is, Satoshi says here, a peer-to-peer network. This is network, just think of it as like as soon as you install the Bitcoin software on your computer and you can run the entirety of Bitcoin. Understand that. If you go to bitcoin.org or you go to GitHub and you download the official Bitcoin client, like the one that started all of this and anything that's compatible with the Bitcoin network as it is, you're running the whole thing. Everybody else, nobody has any piece of code or line of code or block of anything that you don't have on your computer. You're running the whole system from top to bottom. The network emerges from the fact that many tens, hundreds of thousands of people are all running this exact same software. And importantly, they're all doing the same verification. They're all checking everyone's work and confirming the records and the transactions of where those 100 tokens are going. And they are all coming to the same answer. Even though they're on different machines, they're on different operating systems, they're using different software languages, everything comes out to the exact same conclusion. And thus, you have a network that all has the same consensus. All of these people, by doing the work on their own computer and verifying that the spreadsheet is correct, that the records have not been cheated, and that the history is very clear or 100% accurate and hasn't been counterfeited, a network emerges because everyone can share this information and they are in consensus because there's a set of rules that everyone is running on all of these computers. And when they test the Bitcoin chain, the Bitcoin record that is just public, it's out there. Everybody has it. Everyone who runs what is referred to as a node has a full copy of it. And everyone's node computes the exact same answer, either a yes or a no. And if no, they keep looking for accurate data, and everybody simply checks for themselves and refuses any data that is inaccurate. So if somebody tries to counterfeit Bitcoin, somebody tries to double spend, if you're running the software, your computer just checks and says, nope, that's a counterfeit. Nope, that's a double spend. Nope, that's a bad signature, et cetera, et cetera. And it just rejects it, just says, nah, I know you're cheating. And that's the thing. Imagine a bank where, like, the purpose of a bank is to keep the ledger of everybody's transactions, right? And run credits and debits so that they debit my account and they credit yours when I'm sending you 100 tokens in the bank. But there's nothing actually there, like the bank. The bank just has tokens on the spreadsheet. That's all it is. And in fact, the bank can actually just go in and punch stuff, punch in an amount and just be done with it and create new units. In fact, they do that when they issue loans, but that's a whole nother story. But their whole job is just to manage a ledger. Essentially, what Bitcoin does is it gives the entire ledger to all of the customers. And all of the customers run the ledger themselves. And they audit the entire system. They audit the entire bank. And the bank is just another peer. And when anyone sends a transaction, tries to spend 100 tokens, they prove their digital signature that those tokens belong to them, and they broadcast it out to the whole network of all the bank customers. And every single person checks, is this accurate? Is this a good signature? Do I actually have 100 tokens? They look on the ledger. Yes, this is accurate. And everybody updates their ledger. Everyone audits. Everyone verifies. Everyone makes sure the cryptography works out. And everyone updates their ledger according to the exact same rules. Because the rules are public and easily verifiable. They are built into the software. So it's like a game where everyone is a referee. And the rules are so unambiguous. They are so blatantly objective because the rules are built into, or literally math equations, essentially. It's software. They're so blatant that everyone can be a perfect ref. There's no, like, almost calls, right? You know, like, you know, when you have like a bunch of refs and everybody's like, oh, you know, he stepped a little bit out of bounds. No, he was in bounds. And, you know, they have a conflict and they get together and they look at the replay. You don't have to do any of that because there's an explicit, like, down to the 100 millionth of a Bitcoin unit. Like, there's no ambiguity whatsoever. It's all math. Either the answer is correct or the answer is wrong. Now, all we've done with this analogy is distribute the banking ledger to a bunch of peers, but we still don't have the ability to, what if an adversary, like myself, let's say I'm trying to double spend my 100 tokens and I have my digital signature, it's valid, and I broadcast it to half of my peers, and there's like an isolated network or something, and I send it to Bob, and then I really quickly sign that same transaction and send it to Bill as well. I send it to him and they broadcast it out to the network. And now part of the network says Bill has 100 tokens and the other part of the network says Bob has 100 tokens. How do we know which one is actually accurate? How do we know? And if it's a peer-to-peer network, we don't really know which one I sent out first. Like, we can maybe have a guess. And one node can say, oh, I got it first, but how does anybody know that that's not just a fake node of mine where I just changed the time? I can just change the time in my computer and then stamp it and just be like, oh, no, I got this one like 30 minutes early. It's definitely Bill's. And really what I just did is I double spent against Bob. Well, that doesn't work. In an adversarial network, you can't trust any of the information. So how do we know that one of them is true and one of them is not? By hashing them into an ongoing chain of hash-based proof of work, forming a record that cannot be changed without redoing the proof of work. What the hell does that mean? Now, this single sentence is basically multiple episodes worth of explanation, probably. And I'm thinking this will be a good place for the second basics, Bitcoin basics episode, is hashing and proof of work. But for our purposes right now, I just want to give a simple analogy to make sense of this. First off, essentially all this is a cryptographic trick to make it so that when one part of the network stamps my transaction to Bill and or Bob and produces a what's referred to as a valid proof of work, the two parts of the network, the one that got Bill's transaction and the one that got Bob's transaction, are competing to stamp their transaction first. And going back to those rules that we all play by in the network, whoever gets the stamp first, whoever cements which transaction first, Bill's or Bob's, becomes the official transaction. And the other half of the network, let's say it was Bill's transaction that finally got cemented into the Bitcoin record, well, then that means every part of the network, everybody on the part of the network that had Bob's transaction, throws away Bob's transaction and downloads and accepts the record from the other half of the network, so that everybody is again in consensus. And that's part of the verification. And this is the stamp. And this is what they mean when you hear a transaction has been confirmed. And sometimes it takes a little while for the transaction to be confirmed. And you'll also hear that a transaction is not final until it's confirmed. Because just like in my example, part of the network might have gotten Bob's transaction and part of the networks might have gotten Bill's. But if I only had 100 tokens, only one of those is going to get confirmed, because it's not valid for both of them to be so. And there's a lot more involved and a lot more working pieces, but each one of them needs to be explained to understand why this does ultimately solve the double spending problem. But this is the kind of ultimate problem of a digital cash system. So I think that's enough to try to digest for today for those of you who are new. And because I know it can be a lot, let's just briefly go back over everything we talked about, just hitting the larger ideas. So first off, money is a record-keeping system. And the reason it's a record of the value that people have produced in the past so that they can retrieve it back from the other people in an economic system, in an economic network, which is literally defined by sharing the same communication medium, the same money. One of the most important attributes of that money is that it could not be counterfeited, and it was incredibly scarce, insanely difficult to make more of the money. That is why, historically, a physical good that was a physical element, usually, or item that was very, very difficult to make or acquire ended up becoming the money. Now, obviously, there are other characteristics, but this is a crucial one. You can have all of the other characteristics of money, and if it doesn't have this, then it falls apart. It will never actually sustain the value necessary to be a record of exchange. Then we move to virtual monies, but they were tied to physical things in an effort to mimic this critical property, the inability to counterfeit it, and the scarcity of the physical good that it was quote-unquote redeemable for. However, the only way to enforce this characteristic was to have a central party, a central bank, a regional bank, a trusted, you know, tribes leader, a government, whatever it was, in order to keep the physical item and redeem the notes. And this historically is universally and horribly abused, because this means that the person who creates the redeemable notes can counterfeit while no one else is able to, or at least it's very difficult for everyone else to do so. And what this means is that that person or that group of people now has the ability to consume resources and parasitically siphon all of the value out of the economy without ever having to put anything in, while everyone else can only get the money by offering value in exchange. They put money into the economy and, or excuse me, they put value into the economy and only that much are they able to get out. Whereas someone who can counterfeit puts no value in and they can just take it out at essentially infinitely until the money is destroyed. Virtual monies always required a third party in order to fake, in order to make it appear as if it had this critical characteristic. Bitcoin is the first digital money. It is a system, it is a standalone system that has no center. It is a peer-to-peer network where everyone who participates, everyone who becomes a node on this network, runs the whole system, runs the whole piece of software. You can download it onto your computer and you can check top to bottom the entire architecture of the software. But in that software is a set of rules that you can verify. And your software checks a public record of transactions against those rules, and everyone shares it. When someone has a more updated version, like in the example of Bill's and Bob's transaction, when someone gets Bill's transaction and they realize that their neighbor doesn't have Bill's transaction, they update it and they share the ledger. They share this public record of everyone's transactions and all of the Bitcoins that exist. And they all check them. Like everyone is a referee. Everyone is a full auditor. There isn't, it's not like the Central Bank of the United States, the Federal Reserve, where you have to fight and try to get legislation passed to audit the Fed, and then you're still just trusting that they gave you the correct information. Bitcoin is audited every second of every single day by default. The very running of the software is auditing the entire thing constantly and in perpetuity. And everybody does it. And everybody is a referee. Everybody judges. Everybody flags up a red card when they check against their rules. And because everyone checks, and everyone audits, and everyone confirms, they all come to the exact same answer at the end because they all have the same rules, or as long as they have the same rules. I'll say that, because if you change your rules, that's how you make a fork. That's how you make Bitcoin Satoshi's vision and Ethereum and all this stuff. You change your rules and you're no longer part of the same network. So the network emerges from the fact that you have a bunch of people that all agree on what the canonical Bitcoin is, what the current and valid record of all of monetary history in the Bitcoin world is, down to the 100 millionth of a unit, without question, without ambiguity, objectively, according to the math. It is a perfectly fair and perfectly verifiable game where everyone is a referee. And this game is the game of money. And the game of money is the game of life. Without money, there is no civilization. Period. It does not and cannot exist without a scaling system for economic cooperation. That is what money is. An unfair, corrupt money produces an unfair, corrupt society. Bitcoin is the first digital money, not virtual, digital money, that has solved the double spending problem without a central party. And in doing so, it's able to accomplish the counterfeit proof and incredible scarcity that was only ever achievable by a physical item before, gold being obviously the prime example, and is why virtual monies were always redeemable for gold, because only gold could actually sustain those attributes. Now those attributes can be sustained digitally. That is ultimately the innovation of Bitcoin. That is the great leap forward of the Bitcoin system. Digital scarcity. And the real magic of how Bitcoin works is in that crazy sentence that's really hard to pull anything out of with the proof of work and the hash-based chain of stuff. because what it is able to do is create its own internal sense of time. And that is why we can confirm Bill's transaction and know and agree to reject Bob's and this can't be undone. And we move forward into the future and do the next transactions and the next. And ultimately, I am only ever able to spend the 100 tokens that I provably had. And then when I give them to Bill, they are gone forever and Bill is the only owner until he sends them to someone. And only one transaction gets confirmed and everyone validates and everyone updates and everyone continues to move forward. And we are going to, I don't know if we'll do that in the second episode, because there are a lot of basic pieces of the, you know, the cryptography and things. And I hesitate. We have to get technical in a lot of this, but I prefer staying big picture for explaining a lot of these things and analogies. Unfortunately, I feel like there's a couple, like hashes are the bread and butter of Bitcoin. Like, hashes are everywhere. You hash every transaction, you hash the details, the signature is essentially a hash, the public and private keys are hashes of each, hashes are everywhere. Proof of work is a hash, blocks are hashed. So it's a very important thing, and I think it deserves its own episode. We're going to go over, addresses, just how to interact with Bitcoin, what are the main pieces of Bitcoin, and I hope to cover it all, but I am kind of making this up as I go. I don't know. I still have a hard time with the perspective of people new to this space, like what's most confusing. So please feel free. Again, Fountain is a really great way to do it. If you want to boost in, send a message or whatever, in order to A, let me know if I explained it well, or if you still have questions, I'll try to address them in the next basics episode. And also, what are you having problems with? That will maybe help give me a direction. You're also free to, if you don't have a Lightning wallet and you haven't used Fountain or whatever, I urge you to check it out, because Fountain is really easy to use. But if you don't have that yet, you can always DM me on Twitter or Telegram. I will have a link in the show notes to the other things that I mentioned, the other episodes and reads. So we've got Guys Take 44, which Bitcoin is not what you think it is. And I kind of take the little bit that I said and the overview I said about money, and I kind of go into it a lot deeper and tangent quite a bit more on a lot of other topics around that. But like I said, that's been a helpful episode for some people, and I particularly enjoyed doing it. Then there is the Bitcoin white paper, which I encourage you to read. It might be, or listen to. And it might be a little bit much right now. Maybe hang on to that one. But even if you only grasp 20% of it, it's still really, really good to get through. So I will link to that one. Layered Money, long, amazing book, very dense, by Nick Bhatia. It is incredible. I highly, highly recommend it. And it's standalone without Bitcoin. In fact, he doesn't really get into technical details too much. He does kind of talk about a big picture architecture of how Bitcoin works and how to think about it. But really, it's more about how money came about, how layered monetary systems emerged and evolved, the history of it, and why Bitcoin is far different than most people picture it today. They think that it's some points on the internet that are at the top of all of this stack, when really it's a competing base to an entirely different hierarchy, to an entirely different monetary pyramid, so to speak. Then I also mentioned 21 Lessons by Dergigi. Like I said, it's just going to fascinate you and entertain you, and you're going to learn something. And you can dive into that one at any point, highly recommended. And then the article from Gigi that I was talking about, Digital Money, or Bitcoin is Digital Money. I don't remember what read it is, but like I said, I'll have it in the show notes. These are all great ones to explore, to kind of expand on a lot of these topics and to kind of get the full argument of a bunch of the little, seeds, little pieces and crumbs of things that I dropped throughout this episode. But with that, let's go ahead and close this one out. I think we've covered enough for today. We will be back with another read tomorrow and lots of other stuff in the works. So stay tuned, Stay subscribed. A huge thank you to everyone. I actually will read the comments. I know I read only one today from the Fountain Boosts, but I'll read another handful of them tomorrow. Just a shout out to Eric99 for his boost. Holy crap, thank you. And thank you everyone who has supported in all the different ways you support the show. Audionauts, thank you. I love you guys. And also just a little tidbit just to share because I'm so freaking excited about it. My miners are running. I can hear, they're very, very faint, but they're downstairs in the basement and I can hear them right now. They're humming away and they're hashing Bitcoin. They're running that proof of work and providing that double spend protection. And we will explain in Basic Bitcoin Basics, episode 2, what that means and why. So stay tuned. And again, thank you all. And thank you to Swan Bitcoin, to CoinKite, and to Fold. Swan Bitcoin is the best onboarding. CoinKite is where you're going to keep your Bitcoin safe, is how you're going to keep your Bitcoin safe. And Fold is how you're going to fix your fiat. Because nobody should have to use fiat unless they're getting paid sats. That's why you do Fold. All right. I will catch you all on the next episode of Bitcoin Audible. Until next time, everybody. Take it easy, guys. Bitcoin is peer-to-peer in every sense. It is so by design, and it could not be any other way. As free and open source, it is peer-to-peer software. As consensus-driven software, it is a peer-to-peer protocol. As a censorship-resistant protocol, it is a peer-to-peer app. As a distributed app, it is a peer-to-peer network. As a communications network, it is a peer-to-peer language. And as a peaceful language, it is a peer-to-peer community. Bitcoin is Venice. Alan Farrington and Sasha Myers.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.